first words or phrases that come to your mind when I say conflict? Okay, we're going to have a good session, I can tell already. Wait a second, you're one ahead of me. Did I hear challenge?
Yes.
Okay, and you said?
Fighting.
Castle? Okay.
Anger. I guess you don't have anger. You have anger?
Management.
Management,
Misunderstanding.
Let me ask a question about management. Is that a management of conflict or management at work?
Management at work.
Like with the boss? People.
Or with the folks I'm trying to manage.
Okay. Okay. Next word was?
Misunderstanding.
Frustration.
Couple more? Words or phrases you associate with conflict?
People?
Change. Okay. What do you think of this list? What do you think when you think of this list?
Lots and lots of negatives.
Misunderstanding, hassle, arguing, unpleasant, hostility. I'm assuming that anger has negative connotations for people. People tend to associate conflict with lots of negative things and hope that there's some way to avoid conflict or end conflict. I start out with a different position on conflict, which is that it is inevitable, it's part of life, it's there, and what we need to do is not end conflict or eliminate conflict, but learn how to manage it in some constructive way to get rid of some of the negatives and maybe even highlight some of the positives like change and challenge and excitement. Okay, so that's my starting point on conflict. Let me tell you briefly what I think a conflict is. I think a conflict exists when the goals that I want are blocked. They can be blocked by something. So I can be in a state of conflict. I'm going on a long hiking trip this afternoon. And the shape that my body's in, my lung power, could be blocking my getting to the goal. I could be in a state of conflict with myself, or I could be in a state of conflict with somebody else. The things I'm saying here apply to conflicts between groups as well as conflicts between individuals. So we could use as our examples the situation of South Africa and conflict there. There, one group clearly sees that its goals are being blocked by another group. The blacks in South Africa see their goals of a happy, healthy life, whatever, and their right to vote and participate in their country is being blocked by the whites. The whites also see their life is being blocked by the blacks. So we have a state of conflict there. And some of the material I'm going to be sharing with you is material that I learned from a man who spent a lot of time in South Africa last summer with groups of blacks and whites, training them in conflict and negotiation techniques. So you can apply these ideas on lots of different levels. Okay, I start out with the idea that conflict is inevitable. We learn how to handle it. We have to learn how to handle it better than we do. Let's look at how we do handle it. Let's say this is my last day at Holden Village. I'm leaving tomorrow, and I really want to go on a hike with you. You want to go on a hike with me. You're leaving tomorrow also. We'll never be back here. We really want to have a special time. I want to go to Heart Lake, and you want to go to
Holden Lake.
Holden Lake. Well, I was going to save that for my solution.
Copper Basin.
Okay. You want to go to Copper Basin, and I want to go down. What's the trail that has a lot of wildflowers on it? Down to the Beaver Pond. Okay. What should we do? Let's say I say to you, I really want to go to the Beaver Pond. I really want to see wildflowers. I love wildflowers. I won't be this high in the mountains again for who knows how long. You can go up high any time. Let's go to the Beaver Pond. What do you say to me?
Oh, the flowers aren't blooming this time of year. It's too late. You have to be here early in the spring. Let's really do the other hike. It'll be a lot more fun. There's lots of wildlife on the other hike.
Okay. I don't think there's enough wildlife on the other hike. I really want to go to the Beaver Pond.
You should have done Gertrude's nature walk, and if you wanted to see wildflowers, there just aren't enough out there, and I really want to spend the day with you. I really think you're being difficult.
Attack. Okay, we're getting going here. What we're into is a situation that I would call a competitive situation. Okay, we'll use that as an example. Compete. First way of dealing with conflict. In a situation of competition, she's saying, you lose. And I win, right? That's I. She wins, I loses. We're gonna do her thing, I'm not gonna do my thing, or vice versa. One of us is gonna win, the other one's gonna lose. When she started getting into you always blah, 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 I was thinking about our session on anger last week. And those of you who, some of you might wanna listen to that discussion, or there's some sessions on anger today, because these two topics really fit together. Is there anything else we could do besides compete? What if I say once again, I really want to go to the Beaver Pond and see the wildflowers?
I could just give in and go your way.
Sounds great to me. Okay, what would we call that? I want to make sure I get my labels right. Accommodation, okay? Accommodate. Whoops.
Is that accommodation?
Okay, I'm getting confused because of the eyes here. Let's say I lost the first time and you won. This time I win and you lose. Do I have two M's in there?
Yes.
Okay, accommodation is simply the opposite of competition, where still one of us loses and the other one wins. This time the tables are turned. I get my way. How do you walk away feeling? How do you feel about me? How do you feel?
I shafted myself again.
Okay, so what may be important is how you feel about you. You walk away with a lot of anger, a lot of bad feelings about yourself. Okay, once again, the tape on anger may be relevant here. What else could we do? Could we do anything else? Aha, that's what people like. What would a compromise be here? Oh, sorry. What would a compromise be?
Find a trail that goes high that has wildflowers.
Okay, you're getting into another strategy. Let's use compromise to describe a situation where I win a little bit and you win a little bit. Okay? We both win, but a little bit. So, neither one of us gets everything that we want, but we both get a little of what we want. I don't know a trail. Let's imagine a trail that goes up a little way, goes to a lake a little way, which is one of the things you wanted to do, let's say, and has a lot of wildflowers in it, not as many as I would like. Let's say you wanted to go explore it because you wanted to go fishing. There aren't a lot of fish in that lake. We just caught fish here for 20 years, but who knows, today could be the day. We both win a little bit in a compromise situation. Okay. There's one thing that we haven't talked about that was the very first word that I put up here in your associations to anger, which was what?
Avoid.
Okay. Neither one of us wins in avoid. We say, gee, this is terrible. We're having this big fight about where to go. Let's just stay in the village today. It's our last day. We'll stay in the village. We won't go on a hike. We won't go to either place because we really can't figure out where to go. Let's just avoid the conflict. So, when you avoid dealing with the conflict, no one wins. The last one that I'm saving for the goodie, right, there's always a goodie coming here, is what I call collaborate. Collaborate. Feel free to correct my misspelling. My undergraduate students always do it gleefully, so you should too. And collaborating, what we're trying to do is switch this conflict situation into a problem-solving situation. And I'm going to give you some ideas for how to do that so that we both win a lot. Now, the first thing you're going to tell me is, isn't it the case that there are lots of situations where we can't both win? And certainly that's the case in a lot of situations. But in many more situations than we usually think of, if we start thinking in terms of problem solving, instead of competing, instead of either or win-lose terms, we can begin to figure out a solution. The material, there might be some, the material that I'm going to share with you about collaborating comes from a book called Getting to Yes. Have people heard of that book? Are you familiar with it? There's a project going on at Harvard, a research project on negotiation and conflict. And this is one of the first books produced by it. It's a very interesting book. And they give you some suggestions for how to get to yes, which I will get to in a minute. Before I get to those, let's think about these strategies. I'm posing collaboration as the best, the thing that you ought to try and do if you can. But there might be situations in which you want to do some of these other things. Can you think of a situation where the best thing to do might be to avoid conflict? When might you want to avoid conflict?
Often with a child where the issue is not really that significant, it's really a lot easier to just avoid it and distract their attention and not make it an issue. Save your time to making an issue for a more important.
Okay, are you talking about avoiding or accommodating? Accommodating means the child gets whatever he or she wants.
Not really. I would try to distract them and move them to something else, so I would try to avoid it.
Okay, good. That's avoiding. It's something that's not terribly important to you. You assume it's not terribly important to them. Is that fair to say? So you just want to shift gears and let it go.
A good example of avoiding is when you're in a foreign country where there are hostile people, you do not want to come in conflict with hostile people.
Okay. You know you're going to lose, so you want to avoid conflict. So it may be a situation where something's not terribly important to you, or it may be a situation where you know you have no hope of winning, so you avoid conflict completely.
Uh-huh. Or if you're dealing with someone who's emotionally unstable.
Someone who's unpredictable. Which gives me if I'm dealing with you and I know that that's something that you don't want to deal with, one way I can always get my way with you is to be very emotionally unstable. That could be a strategy. You may want to choose whether or not you want to use it, but when we talk about power, there are lots of things that may appear on the surface to be powerless that are actually very strong, effective strategies for getting your way. Whether or not you want to use them is another matter. You might want to avoid conflict, though, in some of these things we suggested.
How about when your conflict is adversely affecting other people?
Okay, can you give me an example of what you're thinking of?
I would say husband and wife conflict in the midst of a family gathering. Mm-hmm. Or when other people are around that are relying on them.
Okay, you might want to save it till you get home.
Maybe that's postponed.
Well, avoiding it temporarily. It may not be the appropriate situation for it. Okay, that's interesting. I mean, I'm glad you mentioned that because I think that people don't learn very good ways of handling conflict when they grow up because people think they can't fight in front of their children. And I think that what the message children get is conflict is something very scary, and it's so scary that mommy and daddy have to do it behind closed doors. And I think those kids know there's tension in the air, and they know there's shouting going on behind closed doors. So in lots of, I will say lots, but of course it depends on what you're fighting about, and how intense the fighting is, and whether you have construct, whether you went to the session on anger last week, you know how to say things in terms of I, sort of accusing and aggressive and all that. I think a lot of times it's good to fight in front of children because it teaches them that anger and conflict are not these scary things that we have to hide, that we have to run away from and tiptoe around. But it's possible for mom and daddy to be angry at each other and work that conflict through, and then 20 minutes later, things are okay.
Another point, too, is that if children don't see their parents working out difficulties,
mm-hmm.
they think that perhaps that there are no difficulties, and so then they don't have a good role model to work it out later either.
Okay. I would say that it's not that they think there are no difficulties. I think kids are really sharp at picking up tension. But it's that they may not be aware that there are difficulties. They may not be conscious. It may not be out on the table. But kids, I think, pretty much sense when there's a lot of tension in a house, especially if it's tension that goes on for a long period of time. I think they really feel that tension. But if it's never talked about, if it's never dealt with directly, then it's very hard for kids to get a handle on. So if we all go around with the idea that conflict is unpleasant, is terrifying, is scary, is negative, and we try to hide it from kids, that's what they're going to learn. They're going to learn to hide it too.
There's a lot of ethnic differences in how people deal with this stuff. Some people are just out fighting and arguing all the time, and the Norwegian types kind of don't do that as much.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of that?
Well, I think it works both ways. I don't think, I mean, I'm not necessarily thinking that we all have to be Middle Easterners just because we were born Northern European.
Mm-hmm.
Although today it seems like that may be healthier, but I'm not sure it's true.
Well, you're associating dealing with conflict with a lot of screaming and anger and a lot of emotion and intensity. And maybe that's not necessarily the way of dealing with conflict that's appropriate to you. Maybe you can state your needs in a calm, matter-of-fact voice. I don't think it's necessarily the case that conflict has to be associated with all that other stuff. What I think is important is stating your needs and your position part of it, which is different from the attacking the other person part of it.
I guess I'm thinking of television where there's so much played out on the screen that people are forever conflicting with each other. And that gets to be a real role model for kids, more than what they see at home.
I think certainly those are important. I think what they see at home is really more important in the long run. Because mommy and daddy are really powerful people, especially when they're really little. And there are some other models on television too. The Bill Cosby show shows a lot of family conflicts being handled without everybody screaming and raging and hitting and storming off and slamming the door. But if you watch that show carefully, I think that there's a lot of conflict on that show between generations and among the kids that gets worked out. So dealing with conflict directly doesn't necessarily mean learning how to shake your fist in the air at all. Okay. And if you think that it does, that might be blocking you from dealing with conflict. You can certainly, there are lots of different appropriate ways to deal with conflict that don't all include that. When might you want to compromise and not fight for your whole position? Can you think of an example of a situation where compromise might be appropriate?
Sometimes there's not time to collaborate and come up with an original idea,
mm-hmm.
and you need to just compromise at that time instead of sit down and think or take the time to find a new solution that will be a win for both.
Okay. So time pressures might be some part of the problem. Maybe it's something that's not terribly important to you again, and you're willing to give in. Maybe the compromise is pretty acceptable. All those kinds of situations. What about accommodating? When do you want to accommodate?
Maybe you've been winning a lot of them, but it's
not time. Excellent point. Let's say you're the negotiator for... somebody brought up management. Maybe you're the negotiator for the union side. You've won 3 points, management hasn't won any. You let them have their last point because you want them to go away whole. also. You want them to feel okay about going away. So there might be times to accommodate. When would you want to compete? Something that's really important to you, a matter of principle, something that's essential to your well-being, essential to your group's well-being. It might be a situation where you really want to fight it out and compete. So any of these situations, any of these strategies for handling conflict can be appropriate. You need to think about what's going on in the situation, how important it is to you, etc. If you want,
I can see that in a classical negotiation, every one of these comes into play in reaching an agreement.
My friend who I spoke to you about, who worked in South Africa, used to work for the U.S. government in a branch of the government that would go in community conflict situations. He negotiated the settlement at Wounded Knee, for example. I'm trying to get him to write his work autobiography because he's been involved in so many interesting conflicts. And he uses all of these all of the time. Some of them more than others in different situations. But if you want to be a good negotiator, if you really want to get your way, you have to be flexible and be able to use all of them. If your strategy is to always compete, you're really going to burn yourself out. You're also going to lose a lot. but you can see you need all of these. What if you want to collaborate? Let's get into that a little bit. And I'll share with you some of the material from the book Getting to Yes. Anybody? You want to sell it by tossing a coin? That would be competing, but it's up to the coin to figure out who wins, I guess. One person would win everything, the other person would lose. So it depends on which end of the coin you come down on, whether you're competing or accommodating. It would be one of those. Okay, the first thing that the book Getting to Yes suggests you do if you want to collaborate is you separate the people from the position, okay? Now those of you who are familiar with the book, I want you to help me out here in explaining and bringing it to you. Let's say you're my spouse and we're having this discussion about where to go on the hike. And what's going through my mind is, you're my spouse, you get your way all the time, I really want to do this. I'm not going to let you get your way again. What I'm really doing is fighting with you as a person, and I'm not dealing with the issue, which is, where are we going to go on the hike today? So, the first thing to do, and this is not always an easy thing to do, especially for people like union and management, who've been in conflict for a long time, with blacks and whites in South Africa, been in conflict situations for a long time. But separate the people from the position. Forget about who is holding a particular position and think about the substance of the position. The second thing, and this is the most important thing, is to focus on people's interests and not their position. And what I mean by that is that you have a set of reasons why you want to go on a hike to a particular place. Focus on those reasons. So instead of saying, I want to go here, you never go here, you always get your way, etc., I might say, what is it about so-and-so lake? Why do you want to go there? Why do you want to go to Donkey Lake? That's where you want to go. And you would say, I really want to go fishing. I've carried my fishing gear all the way from Chicago. I've gone fishing once. I didn't even take those fish home. This is my last chance to go fishing in the Cascade Mountains. I really want to go fishing. Why do I want to go where I want to go? I really want to see wildflower meadows. It's one of my favorite things to see in the world. I never get to see them at home where I live. I really want to see a wildflower meadow. Once we get our interests out on the table, then we can figure out a solution that might include both wildflower meadows and good fishing. So my Holden Lake comes in. Okay? Holden Lake has both of those things. As soon as we get away from our position into our interests, the reasons for holding those positions, we can start to work on a problem-solving strategy that may accommodate both of, I shouldn't use the word accommodate, that may meet both of our interests. Okay? So instead of just holding to that position of, I want a 7% pay raise if I'm your employee, say, and you say, we only have money for a 3.5% pay raise in the bargaining, we might look at some of the employee's interests. Well, what about the health plan? What about time off? What about some of your other interests, as well as money? And see how you came up with that 7% figure, and then try to do something about that. Maybe you came up with that 7% figure because mortgage rates are so high. So maybe the company can have a mortgage plan for its employees.
You've made an interesting shift in your case. When you started out, you had two folks who apparently met here and were going to do something together and shift. And your statement was you'd never see each other again. The last shot was your spouse. And to me, there is a very great difference between resolving a problem where it's one shot and that's it. And the other one is where you are being very mindful about what happens tomorrow and a week and a year from now.
Okay, what's the difference?
I'm much more likely to be belligerent if it's a one-shot accommodation.
Okay.
Because I'm going to take what I can get and have my way. And what you feel about it tomorrow, that's your worry. On the other hand, if it happens to be my spouse that I'm concerned about, or my employer, or any situation in which I have a long-term relationship coming up, I'm much more likely to either avoid or to accommodate or if possible collaborate.
I think you're absolutely right that I shifted the situation when I brought in my spouse. Don't tell him I called him that. When I brought in a relationship that's ongoing that I want to continue. But what I think it did, if you can remember the list of strategies on the board, is shift me from a situation where I might want to compete because it's a situation where I don't care if the relationship lingers to a situation where I might want to accommodate. So I would say I'm shifting the situation and I'm choosing a different strategy perhaps. Or perhaps I'm going down to collaborating because collaborating and problem solving would be a way to maintain that relationship and try to meet both of our needs at the same time. That's the win-win situation. That's the best of all possible worlds. The book Getting to Yes is very optimistic about getting to yes. And they argue that many situations can be turned into collaborative situations. I'm a little less optimistic. But there we are. I'll give you the optimistic view today, and then you can share my pessimism. But you are right that if it's a relationship that you want to continue, you might choose a different strategy. But in their terms, that would be all the more reason to do this analysis that we're doing and to use these techniques. So I would separate my spouse from the position he holds. I would look for his interests. I mean, I look for the reasons why he wants to do what he wants to do and see if there's some creativity there. The third principle in getting to yes is to be creative. There are lots of techniques that psychologists have developed for increasing people's creativity. Usually when we're thinking of solutions, we come up with the same old ones that we're familiar with, that we use all the time. So if you're in a conflict situation, one thing you might do, what you might do is require yourself to come up with four solutions. Okay? Usually you come up with one or two solutions that are the old traditional ones. What if I wanted to come up with four solutions? Holden Lake is one solution. I want you to give me three others to my dilemma about fishing and wildflowers at the same time that I can't think of.
Put the wildflowers on the slideshow instead of taking the time.
Okay, I go to the wildflower slideshow, he goes fishing separately.
Find a mutual interest, something that's going on, substitute.
Okay, find a substitute that we haven't even thought of. Maybe we've never done log rolling. either one of us know that. I think I could be safe in saying my husband's never done log rolling. I know I haven't. Maybe we should spend the morning at the log rolling pond. Maybe that would be really fun. That would be an alternative neither one of us would think about. We need one more.
Well, 2 different days for both. Or do you only have one day?
We only have one day. But maybe split the day into a morning hike and an afternoon hike. That will end my stay here with a real bang. Limping home. But maybe figure out a solution like that. Okay. Another solution? Anybody can think of?
You could shift the whole focus from what it is you're wanting to do to the interaction with that person.
That would be interesting. Let's say, well, instead of going hiking and instead of going fishing and looking at waterfowl, let's sit down and talk about how we talk about it. Have a very different sort of day, but no.
We might bargain with them and say, if you'll do that for me this time, I'll do this and so some other time for you.
Okay. So we could figure out a solution like that. We've come up with lots of things that I didn't think about. Because I stopped at the first solution, which was hold and light, which would give us both fishing and waterfowl. But we could come up, if we wanted to get up to 20, say, with lots of solutions, and then we could evaluate them. One of the key points in creativity is that you will become more creative if you separate the part of the process where you generate ideas from the part of the process where you evaluate those ideas. That's very simply said, but that is very important. Lots of the reasons why people have trouble coming up with new creative ideas is because there's a little sensor going on in their head that's saying all the time, oh, that'll never work. That's a dumb idea. That's no good. You've never tried that. How do you know you can do that? If you can shut that tape recording off in your mind and say, I will evaluate these after I've come up with the ideas, then you're likely to come up with much more creative solutions because you're not blocking yourself.
Mm-hmm. Often in family collaborative scenarios, they make a very strong point that you want to set it like a clock time, like we won't talk about any of the solutions. All we're going to do for the next 20 minutes is brainstorm. Mm-hmm. And we're just going to write all those things down, and when the 20 minutes are up, then we're going to go through them one by one and give mm-hmm. our pros and cons. And that really helps the creative process a lot.
Yeah. A lot of advertising agencies or agencies that have to work places that require creativity have brainstorming sessions exactly like that, mm-hmm. where there's a certain amount of time blocked off, where you just sit and you think of ideas. And you think of as ideas that are as bizarre as you can. Or you say, we have to come up with 20 solutions. What if we had to come up with 20 solutions to my hiking dilemma? We would really come up with some unusual ideas. Afterwards, we evaluate them. If you can separate those two phases, you can be a lot more creative. I learned that myself in writing. I have to do a lot of writing because that's how you survive in the academic world, and because I have a lot of opinions and I like to say them to a lot of people. And writing is the easy way to do that. And I had a lot of trouble writing until I learned to separate these two phases. So now when I sit down to write, I write whatever I feel like. Often it can be gibberish. Usually it's unstructured. Usually it doesn't make any sense at all. But I just sit down and write, and then I critique it, I edit it, I restructure it, I reform it. And I write lots and lots of drafts of things. It's not unusual for me to write, you know, 10 or 12 drafts of things. And since I started writing that way, I have become much more productive in writing. Because I know, first of all, that whatever I write is not necessarily the finished product, so it doesn't have to be perfect. And I know I have lots of chance to revise, so I shut off that evaluation mechanism, and I come up with a lot more things than I think I might have.
Our church has a dream committee, which is kind of neat because it's the same type of thing where, you know, there's a real diverse group selected to meet mm-hmm. like 4 times a year, and there are no limits. You know, nobody is saying, well, you know, this has, how could we ever do that type of thing? You know, we're just, somebody sits and we just come up with ideas that we think would improve mm-hmm. the church or, you know, anything out of that group. That's kind of neat.
I love the name, the Dream Committee, is that what you call it? Do other people use this in their work or church or wherever? Uh-huh. How do you use it?
When my organization has a project for design and it's over budget and we've got to take money away from it, we go through steps called value engineering where we sit down, have a brainstorming session, mm-hmm. and just not evaluate what we're thinking about. Mm-hmm. And just any off-the-wall things, we just make a list of them. And then we leave it to another group to analyze those and mm-hmm. price them. So we get out and we just give the ideas and somebody else evaluates.
That's interesting. So you've really separated the creative part from the implementation or evaluative part. So you can come up with any far out idea you want
Absolutely.
To.
Absolutely.
That's great. That's good. Anybody else use this? McDonald's Corporation has their headquarters outside of Chicago. I've never been there, but rumor has it that they have a brainstorming room. A room that's sort of soft, comfortable chairs where people can sort of sit back and visualize lots of different things. I think there's a person here who's doing a session either this week or next week on imaging. There's a lot of interest now in psychology and imaging and trance states and relaxation and so on. Get yourself very comfortable. Wear loose clothing, sit back, close your eyes, and just let your mind wander and see what you come up with. Sort of say to yourself, hiking, wildflowers, fishing, sit back, see what you come up with.
Two places I wonder if this is ever used. One is school boards and not to get involved in that. And the other one is marriages and counseling. Do they implement that kind of no evaluation? What is it that you really would love to see happen in your marriage mm-hmm. without evaluation? And often I think when there are two things, one of you acts as, I need a man, the other one is evaluation. Mm-hmm. You know, you exchange that position, but it sets up that way so easily.
Right. So one person always has his or her feet on the ground, is the realist, is sensible, all those good words. And the other person comes up with, well, that is. I don't know, I think you could look at marriage counseling as training people to handle conflict in constructive ways, or training people to deal with anger in constructive ways.
But do they use that sort of, I mean, I think that's a transferable style to, I'm just wondering if that's you, that kind of, maybe combine it with what you were saying about imaging, but get it out in front. I'm thinking of it because I'm hearing so much divorce and conflict with what happens. I'm thinking of where we build up. And it seems like a method that's very usable. And I've never, mm-hmm. I just have never seen it operating in either of those two places where I know community breaks down fast. Mm-hmm. School.
So give me an example of how you would use it with the school board.
Well, I think the way this woman suggested their church operates mm-hmm. would be one thing. Mm-hmm. Add a new area that the school board and the teachers mm-hmm. and the students have to all participate in. That's non-evaluative.
Mm-hmm. That would be exciting. I'm having trouble answering your question about marriage counseling because marriage counselors do lots of different things.
Yeah.
In Illinois, anybody can hang out a shingle that says, I am a marriage counselor. Mm-hmm. It's not licensed. So anybody can call themselves a marriage counselor, so what they do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, lots of, this is not to say that all marriage counselors are bad. Lots of them have training and degrees and are skillful, but it's not a field where there's a uniform approach.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Our school board uses it. The Lincoln School Public School Board has forums at every middle school in certain, usually in the springtime. Time of year. Mm-hmm. Teachers, parents, any interested party in the community, the overtaxed aid people could come, anybody. They have a presentation of just where they think they are, you know, briefly, and then they all sit at each member of the board sits at a table. Anybody can go to whichever table they want, and they talk about it. Usually they have a breakdown of parts of the school, and they can just, what do you think, what would you like, what is it that you perceive
and then the school board members get back afterwards, have a retreat, and talk about the things that the people brought up in the forum.
I think that's a great idea. That's a little bit different than brainstorming, in that it sounds like what you're trying to do is come up with a set of goals for the group.
I'm sure that's what the board has in mind, but it's all open. I mean, it's
whatever it is.
You know, if you have a dream for your school, this is your way of getting in touch with your board. So it's kind of open that way. Sure, I'm sure it's for goal setting for the board afterwards.
And you're much more likely to reach a goal if you clearly articulated to yourself what the goal is. Mm-hmm.
You know, I think what caught me was this idea that you actually, it's like confessional lifestyle operates. You allow immediately some bizarre idea to surface so that people are not afraid that their idea will be a bizarre idea. I mean, you open it up that way. I think when everybody's more concerned about being right or being proper or fitting in whatever is expected, creativity doesn't happen. That's what you're saying about writing too, I think. Let nothing, let real gibberish out there. You don't have to be afraid anymore.
In order to do that, you need a situation in which there's pretty much high trust between the parties involved. If there's not trust between the parties involved, if you don't trust the person you're showing your first draft to be firm but gentle, thoughtful but understanding, etc. Although I'm at the point now where the more ruthless people are, the more useful it is to you, because I've really separated my ego from my writing in some way. So it's really useful to me to have somebody who crosses out every other word. If you don't trust that person, though, and you don't think they're really working on the writing, but they're just out to get you, then you're not going to let yourself be open to that.
Well, what I'm thinking is that in these other uses of that sort of stuff, is that if the person in authority, I guess that's what, the person who represents power, who represents maybe the evaluation style normally, is the one who expressed freely some, what you might say, this is impossible, this is out of the, you know, you can't pay teachers and not tax the community and have this terrific school. But if that person expresses something clearly, this is way out of what we usually think we can, yeah, but this is what I really want. Then other people who do not usually have that authority or position of power, I think are free up somehow. I don't know if that's obvious. I have an experience, but I'm guessing of how this might work. And I think power is a for authority is a value given itself. Somebody standing there watching it instead of participating, you're suddenly being evaluated as a brainstormer. So you need all the brainstormers to be brainstormers.
Sure. I mean, unless all the brainstormers really trust that person in power.
Okay.
That's a complex, I would say, fairly unusual situation.
Stephanie, I think that you just hit on a key question for me. That trust. A relationship goes on, and often that trust has disappeared for whatever reason. But the relationship is still there, and you still have to work with that person or that group. What do you do? I mean, you can do all these things if you haven't stopped listing that. But if your past experience tells you you're going to get the shaft no matter what you try, it's difficult to keep trying. Then what do you do? What's your three-word answer?
Well, I'm trying to think of an example to flesh out what you're talking about. And the example that comes to my mind is, say, a divorce case where parents have maybe joint custody but hate each other. Okay? They have to maintain a relationship, and they have to do for the sake of the child or the children, but they really have no trust in each other at all. So what would you do? What would you do in that situation?
Well, you go back to number one, don't you? The position is the child becomes the position, I think, and the spouse becomes the person that you have to separate.
Which is very hard to do. So you might want to get a mediator involved. You might want to get a disinterested, by disinterested I don't mean board, I mean somebody who doesn't have a personal stake in the outcome, person involved. In Chicago, there's a divorce mediation program that seems to be growing by leaps and bounds for exactly situations like that, where there's no trust between the people involved. The stakes are very important to both of them. And
let's throw a rock into that one. One party won't mediate, absolutely won't. Had bad experience mediating 7 years ago. Won't try it again.
You're making life hard for me.
Life is hard sometimes.
What would you do? This is what I do when.
May I use a personal experience?
Please do.
A few years ago, the state of Washington was unable to redistrict its congressional districts. And I was that person.
How did you know?
And you walk into that situation. I'll try to be responsive now to your question because it's a fascinating one.
Yeah.
You have no vote power. You have no disciplinary power. You have no rewards that you can give. You really feel like you're walking in naked to a den of lions. But you have lots of power. You start looking for it. Mm-hmm. You guys want to look like jackasses at the end of this time? Do you want to have people feel that you are so unreasonable, etc.? You mm-hmm. begin to discover all kinds of pockets, sometimes coercive, sometimes wheedling, sometimes playing to ego.
Mm-hmm.
One night you can't go home until you settle this point. It was 4:30 in the morning. There are all kinds of power pockets that mm-hmm. if you think about a little bit, you begin to develop. It's an interesting process.
I think you're making a very important point, which is that power is not a finite resource. It can be created. There's not a limited pie of power that gets divided up in certain ways. You can certainly create power for yourself in all of those ways.
But it does take, I think, your mediator in the middle who becomes the lightning rod.
Mm-hmm.
Because pretty soon the two parties need a place where they can discharge anger and dump mm-hmm. and yell and scream, and the mediator can't serve that function.
Mm-hmm. So if you have to come to a solution, that's the situation that you're in. If you don't have to come to a solution, then nothing would ever get solved. But if you're in, say, a solution like that where the judge says, if you don't do it, I'm going to do it. Or if you're going through a divorce and both parties want the divorce and the judge in the divorce says you have to go through divorce mediation or I will decide who gets custody and how to divide your property,
yes.
Then people are more likely to cooperate because they've got an interest in finding
solution. I didn't mean quite that because the power of the judge is a different kind of power that does not really produce, in my own opinion, an environment in which negotiation occurs readily. I think that negotiation and collaboration and so forth is produced by having your mediator, your neutral chairperson out there who can't do anything to you except as that person can call your attention to the necessity that you act reasonably and stuff.
There's a difference between mediation and arbitration.
Indeed.
You want someone to decide for you, that's arbitration.
Right.
You want someone to mediate, that's someone who serves to bring the two together.
Arbitration is just another form of judicial action.
Mm-hmm.
But mediation genuinely is not. The mediator has no power of decision.
Mm-hmm. So those are quite different situations. And you would use different strategies. If you were the arbitrator, you could have gone in and divided up.
Well, I could have said the first afternoon.
Would your solution have been better than the one that ended
not
up?
Nearly uh-huh. Not nearly as good. Not nearly as good.
So you, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to move off that just a bit. Mm-hmm. Still on point number one,
mm-hmm.
trying to think about domestic situations where you wouldn't be likely to be bringing in a mediator, for example. But
mm-hmm.
you have some practical hints for ways to separate. I'm kind of reading emotion works as people there
mm-hmm.
in part because I find a lot of our domestic little disagreements and things, there's a little emotion behind it, whether it's between me and the kids about what we're going to do or
mm-hmm.
I an hour.
How to separate the emotion. Well, what comes to my mind is the discussion on anger. Again, we had that last week. But you might want to listen to those tapes. You need to think about what the emotion is coming from and how much of it is coming from the situation at hand and how much emotional baggage you're bringing to the situation. Are you following me when I say that? There might be other factors.
I was actually assuming you were going to get more specific, so I know.
Okay, give me an example. Give me an example you're willing to share with everybody. You get more specific. It's hard to talk about it in the abstract, but yeah, well.
I know when dealing with children, well, in fact, dealing with anything in the family, as soon as somebody says something I disagree with, I shut off my ears and I open my mouth and it comes out sometimes. Relationship, the point being discussed. Uh-huh. And I've had three children who say, but Mom, I didn't say that. Uh-huh. And now our oldest is 25 years, and now our 12-year-old says something. I'm more inclined to say, say that again. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to hear what I think you're saying. And it's a definite effort for me to put myself in neutral. Mm-hmm. Because I can feel it rising, and I know I'm shutting off, and I know I'm reacting without thinking. And as soon as I feel that, if I have any coping ability left, it depends on where in the day and what kind of day I'm having, I can say, hold it. You know, tell me again. Mm-hmm. Next, I'll say, what do you mean? I didn't say it. Or she'll give me the look that says, forget it, Mom, took off. You know, and I realize, okay, I did it again. And the act is out, hearing it. But it's a real hard thing for me to walk through. And I think until the day I die, and probably I'll do the same thing to St. Peter. What do you mean? I don't think I can live long enough to learn not to react first and think later.
Well, there's a great technique that you might start using. Somebody mentioned active listening. Before you can respond, you have to say it back to the person in your own words what you think they just said to you.
I'm aware of that and I try it. Sometimes my mouth opens before I put that in here.
But yes, you might say to yourself, I have to wait 5 seconds by the clock before I can say anything. And you might tell your kids, don't listen to anything I say in the first 5 seconds. Remind me that we have this 5 second hold for
months. Well, they figured that out 20 years ago. But it's just a real conversation. I will continue to have to make them.
So you've got a lot of associations going on in your mind. And when your child says the word, what's the word that might trigger something off?
I need.
Okay.
You repeat. Wait.
What do you think? When your child says, I need, what flashes in your mind?
Give me. Okay. I want me.
And so you have this feeling that lots of people are really discussing and pulling out all. So I need a napkin gets the same response as, I need tuition for college.
Yeah. Okay. Not quite that bad, but yes, that's the idea. That's the idea. As I said, the kids have learned, as most people that were close to me, to give me some space. And the techniques in my head, it's a whole lot like living the gospel. I mean, I've got it intellectually, but I don't flesh it out very well with it.
Okay. That's a situation where you need, well, forgive me, to do some real hard introspective and figuring out what those associations are in your mind and what happens, what buttons are pushed. What does the situation remind you of? When your child says, I need, what does it remind you of in your past? There's a lot of emotional baggage. That's what I mean by emotional baggage.
Going back to you, just the big I'm going to bring it up. Of me, and I know I don't need to.
So the more you can identify those reactions, put them into words. I mean, that's what I think is really important. I love language for this reason. Once you put things into words, you can turn them upside down with other words. You can look at them from all sides. You can do lots of things with them once you put those things into words. And you can say to yourself, here I go again doing my I need reaction, you need reaction. Wait a minute, I'm going to slow down. But before you're conscious of it, before you can put it into words, you just react. Mm-hmm.
was just going to say, a lot of practice putting yourself into role-playing situations when you are thinking and are in control, develop the skills so that you can use them. Knowing them doesn't count as much as practicing them. And if you can set aside some time and some just set up obnoxious free problems and do the role playing. Just say, I'm going to role play through this so that you can develop a skill. A skill is not something you can gain intellectually. It's something you have to learn and you have to practice in order to have that skill.
I think it's developed slowly.
In a way of learning, I think Jane Rickey had something yesterday about mentally retarded children learning, their learning skills and what their needs are. And I found it extremely applicable. And it was not just mentally retarded children. Because that kind of learning and realizing, break down what it is you need to learn, get specific, put it into all the senses, walk through it, all those kinds of... And we think we should grab it because we get it intellectually, it ought to be there. And I think you're right, the gospel, you know, gets in here. And where am I expected to keep serving instead of, you know, all these things are, they're not so simple. We get it in our head and keep reading books about self-help books.
Sure, but unless you really start to practice them and do them.
Unless it's concrete in some form.
I think a good place for everybody who came to the session to start would be with your feelings about conflict. Everybody came to this room for a reason, right? Probably because conflict is something that you think about, that you have pretty strong feelings about. And we got a lot of negative associations. We got unpleasant, anxiety, hostility, tension, fighting, all those negative associations. So one place to start thinking would be, where does that come from? What kinds of conflict situations have you been in that have that association? Why is it you react to conflict as something that's going to be destructive as opposed to an opportunity? And then you can start thinking about why that is and why you avoid conflict as much as you can instead of dealing with it as collaboration or even competing. So that's something to think about as you look at the wildfire slideshow. Did you have
most of what you've talked about so far with conflict presupposes that there is a willingness on both sides to collaborate. Mm-hmm. And that ain't always the case.
It doesn't assume that there's a willingness to collaborate. It assumes that there's a need to come to a solution, which is different from a willingness to collaborate.
Well, one of the reasons I mentioned the word management out there, mm-hmm. I thought it was a neutral term, is that there is frequently a lot of conflict resolution by fiat. This is, you know, here's a problem and here's what I want you to do to solve it, mm-hmm. without saying, here's our problem and how can we work together to come up with something in the future. You know, your dean may say, well, I'm sorry, your class size has to go to 45 because we need the money for tuition. Mm-hmm. And you're saying, how can I work one-on-one with 45 people at one time? You know, you get kind of an impasse conflict. Is there a way to back up around that?
Well, then I start thinking about my power strategy. And I might start organizing all the other faculty to go talk to the dean with me. One thing I might do. One of my favorite people on power and conflict tactics, if you're in a situation where you don't have a lot of power, is Saul Alinsky. Some of his books on community organizing have wonderful creative techniques. He did a lot of work in Rochester, New York. And Rochester has a symphony that the city is very proud of. So, I don't know what you'll think of this example, but I'll give it to you anyway. And one of his strategies was to threaten, I never actually did this, but to threaten to have a baked bean supper before the symphony has by lots of citizens. Have a baked bean supper, and you can imagine what would happen. I think he got what he wanted, whatever it was, with that tactic. So that's a situation where you may have a lot more power than you think you do. And you don't necessarily have to accept the power that comes down from on high, the boss. On the other hand, if you do that all the time with everything, the dean is going to see what he can do to get rid of you. So you always start with the least costly strategy. I would go into the dean, first of all, and I would say, I really understand why we need larger class sizes, but in this class, I have people doing a lot of discussion, a lot of exercises. Those things really don't work with 45 people. Would it be possible to have a smaller class in this one and a larger class in that one? Or try to do some joint creative thinking with the dean. So recognize his need to get more money and have him recognize my need and see if we can turn it into a joint problem-solving situation. I have a nice dean, so I think of examples like that. Okay, where are we now? We're actually out of time. So I will thank you all. I will give you the fourth one, which is the hardest one to think about, and then I will thank you all. The fourth one is to try to think of some objective standards to use to evaluate the solution. And that's hard because it's not always possible to find objective standards. The objective standards might be how much it's going to cost your manufacturing people to implement one of your creative solutions or whatever. But, for example, in child custody cases, it's really hard to figure out who objectively would be the best parent to take care of the kid. But they advocate that. I'm not going to bother to write it out, and you might want to think about that in terms of the other solutions, the other ideas. Okay, thank you all. Have a good day.